Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here is your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Thank you, and welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi, professor at Cornell University, extension specialist for New York State, and residing turfgrass expert for turfnet.com and all the faculty and staff at turfnet.com, John Kiger, Pete McCormick. We try to do the best we can to represent them all really well with this Frankly Speaking podcast. And we're going to depart from our usual overview of the website to get with a very special guest who's taken time out of what is, of course, a very busy schedule at this time of year. This is Dave Otis, USGA Director of the Northeast Region of the Green Section up here. As I've just learned recently, for the last 25 years, 27 years entirely with the Green Section, and a proud graduate of Cal Poly Pomona, one of Ken Kurtz's old guys out there. Dave, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for taking time out. How has the spring been going so far for you, Dave?
Well, thanks, Frank. It's great to be here. And you're right, it's a busy time. And the spring has been just about as challenging, I'd say, as the winter. There's quite a bit of damage, although I would say it's probably not as extensive as last year. It's sporadic and all over the Northeast region. And so we've fielded a lot of calls. We've made numerous visits and stop-by visits to observe sick, unhealthy, and dead grass on lots of different golf courses.
Yeah, and so just like last year, and again, you know, you hear and see, like I hear and see, that, you know, Chicago, Detroit, Toronto, last year, it seems to have shifted a little bit south as it came east. I was in Toronto last week. The winter damage didn't look so bad, a little bit of speckling. A lot of the stuff that might have got dinged up last year seems to have gotten dinged up a little bit this year. And so we've got this little bit of sporadic damage, but it appears to be in a lot of different places rather than maybe as just generally devastating, David, as it was last year. Now, herein lies one of the challenges. Just like last year, the spring is just very slow to get going. We're not getting the degree days here in this part of the world as we have in the past. So even with a little bit of damage, David, I mean, what are you thinking? What are guys talking about with just a slow spring? It's almost like you don't know what you got.
Well, that's actually exactly right. People, I think, are still assessing whether some of the POA is just stunted or flat dead. And we just need a little bit more warm weather to clarify the last little bit of that decision-making process, because really, until the last week, there's a lot of POA that we thought was going to come back, and it's continued to decline, and I suspect there's probably still some of that going on farther north. But I wouldn't say this year's damage was as bad as last year, but that kind of depends on where you are. If you didn't have any damage last year and you had quite a bit this year, then obviously it's a lot worse. But last year, the 2013, 2014 was the worst winter I can remember in about 20 years. It rivaled what we saw in 1994 when we had that horrendous ice storm in January and, you know, just wreaked havoc up and down the East Coast. But last year was absolutely catastrophic, and this year isn't as catastrophic, but it affects a lot of different courses this year than it did last year.
So if we look at the damage you see now, right? I mean, to me, it's come down to just a couple of things. And, you know, we rely so much on the USGA, you know, really across the country. You guys doing the visits, you guys dropping in and checking in on us. Not just, you know, you almost become like the internet for superintendents because you see so many that you can talk from place to place. And so I'm going to try to see if we can download a little bit of that knowledge today, David. And again, you know, looking forward, you know, where have we seen the things that are devastating. I mean, typically they're, you know, low spots where ice persists, you get suffocation, and then, you know, you've got exposure damage. Where are you seeing the bigger issues that guys might still need to want to fix? The guys that got really banged up, that they're not waiting to see the damage. They know it's dead now. Where are you seeing that devastating stuff?
Well, it's interesting. I haven't seen the clear patterns of damage like we did a year ago. It was uncanny on many golf courses where we saw south-facing slopes perform much better than north-facing slopes on identically located greens, one oriented a couple of degrees to the south versus the other a couple of degrees to the north. The south-facing melted off quicker and probably didn't experience one or two of those freeze-thaw cycles, which caused most of the damage from my experience. Winter shade, there was a really strong correlation a year ago between winter shade and winter damage, particularly afternoon shade. Morning shade a year ago didn't seem to make much of a difference, but afternoon shade, which resulted in, you know, water refreezing a little bit quicker, that resulted in a lot more damage. So this year, it's low areas where where water sat and pooled and refroze. But I haven't seen such a strong correlation between winter shade and winter damage this year. Although any shaded green typically has more annual bluegrass in it, and, you know, that's the first species to go. I think what's interesting from my perspective this year is greens obviously are severely affected, primarily affected, but there are some courses in southern New Jersey that actually experienced a little bit more damage on fairways, and frankly, I'm at a loss to explain that one. I have never seen that. I've seen just the opposite more times than not, where only greens were affected and not fairways, but some of it's a little bit predicted. One course I know has good exposure to their greens because they've done extensive tree work and they perform just fine. They haven't done a lot of tree work along fairways and they're heavily shaded and they have quite a bit of damage. So it's definitely been the shaded areas of fairways that have suffered the most. But in some
right,
cases,
and it's not like these fairways were without snow cover, right? I mean, I think one of the things that we've seen, you know, certainly trying to look back at the weather, you know, it got cold early November, warmed up a little bit in December. Then it got deeply cold with no snow for a few weeks. Then the snow seemed to come by mid-January, David. Then it just sort of came and stayed. I would imagine it's the same like that up and down the East Coast. And one of the things you and I were talking about, regardless of the weather patterns, one of the things that I thought when we were talking yesterday that I really want to make sure I get your input and get you say it out loud is the importance of monitoring these greens or these areas through the wintertime, almost like a scouting program to determine, you know, when it was alive and when it was dead. And so I wonder if you wouldn't take a minute, Dave, talk a little bit about, you know, the value of taking plugs, you know, how guys do it, and then the kind of information that they get.
Well, that's a really good point because it's common practice to remove plugs from greens at courses farther north that have, you know, that are frequently experiencing winter issues. So they'll just pull plugs, usually a battery-operated saw and or a battery-operated drill with a hole saw, and bring the plugs in and incubate them. And I hate to keep referring to last year, but it was kind of a classic case where this really helped. Superintendents pulled plugs in January. The plugs survived just fine. By early February, they were taking considerably longer to green up, even longer in late February. And by late February and early March, some of the turf wasn't coming back. And so that gave them the information they needed to make an informed decision on whether or not removal of ice layers was justified. Now, last year, it didn't matter if you removed it or left it. There really was no right decision to be made because the temperatures were frigid. They didn't get a good warming spell. So if they removed the ice to get air down there and relieve the anoxic conditions, then the grass died from exposure. This year, and further south, it's just not so common to pull plugs. And so when superintendents have to make a decision, they don't have enough information to make a really good decision. It's always a roll of the dice when you decide to remove or not, But if you don't have the information that, you know, the turf is getting weaker, you're seeing some damage, the carbohydrates are being used up, you can't really make a good decision. So it's a roll of the dice, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
And I'm telling you, these are what the conversations with Kevin Frank and everybody that's, you know, getting their knees into this. I got to experience a little bit of this when I started in Wisconsin, David. Back in 92, I showed up and everything was dead from an ice storm that went through. So while we still sort of struggle about learning how it died and maybe making some changes in the future and knowing that, you know, there's a crapshoot between hydration and desiccation, I mean, as we approach the recovery period now, we've had a slow spring. You know, guys are, I know at Bethpage we've had some damage to some of the black coarse greens. We're seeding. One of the challenges, David, is as we think about shifting to recovery, you know, a lot of these areas are not completely dead, right? You've got sporadic kill. Some of the biotypes might have persisted. If you've had previous winter damage, the bench you've put in there has survived. At what point do you guys have lines about when you look at damage, you say, okay, it's a third of the green, we're going to try to do something different here, we're going to pound the seed? Or, you know, at what point do you guys say, okay, seed, you know, close, put seed and cover, strip it out, turf the damaged area, or you know what? It's time to get rid of POA. You know, as we start looking at this damage more regularly, David, you know, where, and you know, you guys are like me sometimes, sit there having to make a recommendation. Where are you at with what you're telling guys now, regardless of how it died? Okay, it is what it is now. Where do you and how do you develop your recommendations moving forward?
Well, it's definitely a course-by-course decision, you know, and it has to do with what resources they have available, what turf is available. My gosh, last year the bentgrass sod sold out, gee whiz, probably by mid or late March, and so there just wasn't any bentgrass sod to go around. And the other thing is, if you can buy bentgrass, you have to ask yourself, is it going to work well on your golf course, on your greens? If they're heavily played, if they don't have a lot of usable cupping area, if you don't have good traffic flow, if you have poor growing environments, bentgrass isn't going to perform well. So you can spend all the money you want to reestablish greens with bentgrass sod, and they're just going to revert to POA if you haven't, you know, fixed the infrastructure type issues. So I personally would prefer not to sod, and I don't think there's really a line in the sand in terms of, oh boy, you're over 45 or 55 or 65% death. But options include stripping good turf from the healthier, the more damaged greens, and using that to patch the severely damaged ones, and then just sod a few greens to sodding all of them. But in general, I prefer to aerate, slit seed using the newer types of slit seeders, not the old ones, which were a lot more aggressive. Get seed in the ground, you know, fertilize them, get them covered. But the big thing is plug. You know, use the smaller pluggers, 2 or 3 inch pluggers, and just start tattooing the damaged areas with plugs. You know, an experienced team can probably put 60 or 80 plugs in an hour, and if the damage is in isolated smaller areas, that's a huge way to speed up recovery, you know, really dramatically. And if it's your entire green, it may not be practical, but it's something that will help in many, many cases, especially this year. Seems like there aren't too many courses with massive damage. It's just many courses with sporadic damage, certain greens and smaller areas of greens.
So why, you know, I've actually seen some of the guys, you've recommended this smaller plugging strategy as opposed to the, you know, the bigger ones, the hexagon plugs that you oftentimes see. A lot of guys have had really good success, if for nothing else, David, that in the areas that keep dying, you can see the plugs.
Yeah,
continued to put in over the years. What? Why do you think, talk for a second about why you think the 2 to 3 inch plugs maybe are better than the big hex plugs from a recovery strategy.
Well, number one, it's speed. You know, it takes much less time to put in the smaller plugs, so you can put many more per hour than you can with the larger 4 1/4 or even the hex plugs. But more importantly, I think you're really after distribution. If you have lost 20% of the turf on a green, but that 20% is uniformly distributed, then you almost don't need to seed because the existing turf is going to fill back in on its own. When you've lost 20% of a green and all that damage is concentrated in one area, now you've got to take more aggressive action. But the plugs do a couple of things. Number one, you're going for distribution, so get them established to in those damaged areas so that the turf doesn't have to move as far when it's filling in. But number two, and I think more importantly, funny thing happens when you lose grass. You're essentially lowering the cutting height because it's the canopy that's holding up the roller on that mower. So when the canopy's depressed, that cutting height is lower, and obviously we need it to be higher. So if you can put enough plugs in there, that'll actually hold up the front roller on the mower, elevate the cutting height. The plugs obviously will spread, but it takes a lot of stress off of the seedlings that are coming up and some of the weak turf that's coming back. So I think it's a multi-beneficial kind of a program.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I hadn't ever thought about that fact that the plugs actually can help keep the mower up. But ultimately, Dave, now, as we sort of try to tie this winter thing up in a bow, what I find the big challenge, right, especially when you have this sporadic damage, and I'd really like to get your, you know, 2 cents on this, is that is the conflict that clubs and superintendents and golfers have about the decisions superintendents have to make now to establish new turf versus getting the green playable. And so, you know, when I think about that, you know, if I've got an area I got to recover, I need a couple of weeks to actually grow some grass here and then a couple of weeks to prepare it for play. And so even in the best of circumstances, I'm thinking about, you know, 2 to 4 weeks of, you know, 2 weeks of growing grass and then 2 weeks of prepping it for play. I look at it like when you're prepping it for play, I guess you can put the plugs in and maybe that's how you're thinking that the seed then comes on and then my question's moot, but how do you help guys with those conversations between, you know, talking to the golfers about prepping for play and how that might make recovery slower, maybe bring in even weaker POAs that then wind up crapping out on you later versus, you know, giving it time to establish the perennials in there. So what do you... how do you help guys with that conversation between closing them down and establishing them or opening them up for play and limping along?
Well, this is not something anybody wanted. Nobody hoped for winter injury unless you have 70, 80 or more percent bent grass, and then, my gosh, winter injury is your friend. but this is an opportunity, and in a couple of ways. Number one, the new bent grasses that are available on the market today are unbelievably better than what was available 15, 20 or more years ago. So the way I look at it, it's an opportunity to increase your bentgrass populations, but even more importantly, it's an opportunity to increase populations of the new and improved bent. So you're going to upgrade your DNA, so to speak. And to that end, you should have a nursery. Every golf course should have a putting green nursery of matching turf. If you have POA bent, then by gosh, you ought to have a POA bent nursery. But even if you have POA bent or pure POA, you should have a small section at least of an improved bent grass cultivar, one that's really well adapted to your location to serve as a source for those 3-inch plugs, because you can get the better bents, the best bents, into the most critical areas. But in terms of it being an opportunity, it's only an opportunity if you take the right steps, and that means shutting the golf course or the area affected areas down and keeping them closed until they have recovery. And I've seen it, gosh, Frank, 100 times, if not, you know, 1,000 times, courses that keep damaged greens open or open damaged greens prematurely double or triple the recovery time. And at the end of the day, they're weaker, not stronger. So this is an opportunity if you seed and plug and cover and get those grasses established. But if you open them prematurely or don't close in the first place, then you're not going to come out strong, because the the bents that you seed are really slow to germinate and establish. They're really susceptible to traffic, and most of them are going to fail, and you're going to have the old poas come back and new poas come back, and you're just going to be set up for more problems in the future, be it in the summer or the winter. So
Like you're saying, you know, make the, you know, tilt the conversation to this is an opportunity, and then be prepared to sort of build on it. And it's interesting to hear you say now, I wonder if there isn't now, even now that we're getting, whether it's anthracnose or bacterial elation or it's winter damage, you know, we're getting these catastrophic failures from the climate or from pest pressure more frequently. And I'm wondering if what I hear you saying is, you know, maybe golf courses need to have even more time and resources invested in a propagation area where you've got a collection of areas that you're managing, like your playable surfaces, so that you can constantly be propagating this turf when you have some form of failure. Because, listen, Dave, everybody loses a little bit of grass, right?
Yeah, and even if you don't have failure, why not make it a part of your regular management program to constantly add the newer bents to critical areas? You know, when you look at old greens, the highest concentration of bent usually is in the slopes, the unused, the lesser traffic areas, the areas where you can't have a hole location, and the highest concentration of poa is in the most heavily used areas. So why not start a program of putting so many plugs in per day, per week, per month, whatever works for you, into those critical areas, so that when you have a catastrophic event, you know, again, it doesn't matter when it happens, you're just going to be in better shape to handle it. So I completely agree with that. I think it's something I've started recommending the last few years. I think it's a good preventive maintenance program.
Yeah, and I think it gives you some insurance. It's almost like an insurance policy.
Absolutely.
Where you can, you know, it helps you recover faster, knowing that it's getting tougher and tougher, especially in the places where there's lots of play. Now, I'm going to take, and we'll just take a short break here, Dave, and give us a chance to catch our breath here for a second, because when we come back, I want to turn the conversation a little bit to, I know, one of your favorite topics that touches on creating these good growing environments, but also is having a interesting effect on how people are viewing golf courses, and that is the need and foundation up for a good golf tree management program. So when we come back, we'll start talking trees with Dave Otis. And we're back, speaking frankly, with Dave Otis. What a joy. The director of the Northeast region of the United States Golf Association's Green Section for the last 25 years. And boy, are we trying to download that prolific resume on him in the 40 minutes we've got for a conversation. And we've spent our time in the initial part of the conversation today talking about winter injury and recovery preparation. Lots of good little tips and tricks from out there in the field that really have been shown over the years to have some excellent success. And that's, of course, what we get and had the golf industry has come to rely on for many, many years now from the United States Golf Association. And that is that sort of wealth of information that they bring. And I think, you know, nowhere is this more evident, David, in your work, in my opinion, as someone who also travels to and visits a lot of the golf courses that you visit, is the real impact that, you know, after 15, 20 years, pal, people are finally hearing the message about the importance of a tree program. And really the only places left I see where they're not developing some program is where the politics just are lethal, where the guys are just not able, even with a good plan. You know, like in Canada, they have to get permits. But even up there, some of the superintendents are saying, man, it's a lot easier to pay the fine than to go through what it takes to sort of sometimes deal with the challenges. So, Dave, let me take you back 20, 25 years ago when you first started writing these letters to clubs. You know, it's evolved. You know, we want morning shade and growing season. Afternoon shade seems to be more important. But I think the other thing, too, that's really showing up is people are sort of, you start cutting these trees down, Dave, they're like, man, now I can see my golf course again. So what do you think is, you know, how did this conversation start, and how do you think it's evolved to the point that it is now where clubs are really seeing the value to these things?
Well, it has taken an awfully long time, and it's kind of funny because, you know, surveys were done back in the 40s and 50s on good greens versus bad greens, and it became apparent that the bad greens had a lot of shade issues, but it's taken us an awfully long time to get that message across to golf courses. And part of that, I think, is just our innate love of trees. My gosh, I love trees. And so it sounds like you're an awful person if you suggest that healthy trees be eliminated. So when I first started talking to courses about taking out trees years and years ago, boy, people gave me all kinds of horrible looks. And frankly, there were more than a few golf courses that did not invite me back the next year to provide other, you know, disparaging comments about their trees. But people obviously have seen the benefits. And, you know, when I first started doing tree visits, I remember, or started doing tree presentations, I didn't have a single course as an example of one that had taken out a lot of trees. And before long, there were a couple of examples. So when that slide came up in the presentation, gee whiz, it'd be big font. It'd be one column of bullet-pointed courses. And when you do that today, it's multiple slides, two columns, and the smallest font available to show how many courses have done it. Because as the trees have gotten taller, our cutting heights have gotten lower. And so those curves on the graph crossed a long time ago. And, you know, it's imperative that courses do tree work because they cannot grow reliable, good-playing turf without it. So I think lots of courses still don't like doing it. I think many more do like it, and they like being able to see the course again, as you put it. And the difference in turf quality, the difference in the amount of winter injury is quite significant in courses where they have taken care of their growing environments.
So let me get to the obvious question here, David, which is, what do you think was the tipping point? I mean, what, after all these years, I mean, the closest thing I can recall in the conversation was I think when you guys had that open at Oakmont. I think it was a big conversation during the open at Oakmont, and where, you know, where you could see the golf course and not see the golf course. And of course, you know, that those programs were not without their controversy as well. So I'm wondering what you think the tipping point is, because you and I know anybody that does this, they go out, they see it on their course, the benefits that it provides. How do you get it course to course? Our superintendent sort of, you know, strategically saying, okay, just let me try this and see what happens here, and then it goes from there. So what's been the tipping point, or maybe it's a collection of things that happened?
Well, I definitely think it's a collection of things, but you're right. When Oakmont took that action to remove so many trees, it was mind-boggling. And then, lo and behold, we had the Open, and the scores, I think, were higher that year than they had been in previous Opens. So it became clear to people that, you know, you didn't have to have trees to have a really hard golf course. But, you know, the problem started way back when, you know, when the early architects, you know, in the first part of the last century started building golf courses, they didn't like trees. You know, they said they didn't want them on golf courses. Harry Colt called them fluky and unfair hazards. And then in the 40s and 50s, we started planting trees willy-nilly because everybody wanted a beautification program, and it took a long time for those trees to get to a point where they were really harming the turf and blocking views. But so many courses could no longer see the golf course from the clubhouse, and the clubhouse so often is put on the hill so that you can look out over the golf course. It's remarkable. But I think what brought everybody around was the increasing problems with turf, you know, more disease, poor playability, poor reliability, and the fact that people had to start putting in fans when they realized that if they could cut down trees as opposed to putting in fans, that really helped. But I think you're right. I think the program at Oakmont went so well that convinced a lot of courses to do it properly. However, I think in my experience, I would say the courses that were unhappy with their tree programs, you know, maybe they weren't implemented all that well, maybe they didn't take a programmatic approach to it, maybe personal vendettas were carried out at certain courses. But in my experience, the courses that do a thorough evaluation of their trees, they're blown away by the information they get back. They realize that this is a resource that needs to be managed, and probably the biggest problem that we've ever had, aside from overplanting our golf courses, is we just didn't manage the trees. And I would argue that tree populations change more dramatically, they're more dynamic than just about any other component of a golf course. So, you know, we know that we need to rebuild bunkers periodically. We know we need to realign fairways and expand greens back to their original shapes and whatnot. But it took a long time to figure out that our trees needed to be managed. And most people also overlook the hidden costs that trees present, which are significant to say the least.
And so where do you start, David? So I'm with you 100% on this, and not the least of the challenges. You know, when I talk to the tree people here at Cornell, they're like, well, Frank, part of the problem you got with your trees on golf courses is they're getting fertilized and tended to. They grow 2 and 3 times as fast out there as they would in a competitive forest environment. So, you know, you sort of got this monster, just like you say, as a capital part of the infrastructure that requires some level of management. And so, as you said eloquently several times, you want to do it properly. You want to have a tree management program. So where do you start with something like that, David? Does it really start with, you know, the USGA coming out and doing I know you do tree visits now that you alluded to earlier. Is that a good place to start? I imagine that there's arbor companies that can come in and assess your trees. Some guys like Dan Donnelly in Chicago, they have GPS tree inventories, every tree's numbered. So where do you begin if you really need to take this on as a club? Where do you begin the conversation, and what have you seen to be the most successful from a tree management program?
Well, you know, going back 20, 25 years, we would visit problem areas on golf courses, and it was usually a green, and frequently it was a tree issue. And then as I looked up and looked around at these courses, I realized that, man, they didn't just have a tree issue on this green or this tee or this fairway. They were pervasive. And so I started twisting arms and saying, look, we can't do this in a 4-hour visit. We need to start on one and go to 18 and look at every single tree on the property and give it a thumbs up or thumbs down. Ask yourself, if it weren't there now, would you plant one there, you know, tomorrow? And it took a lot of twisting of arms to get people to do this in their exhausting visits, but I think that's the way to start. Absolutely, do a thorough evaluation, look at every tree in a property, and there's a ton of criteria that you need to use. And it's kind of a unique individual that has the ability to take everything into perspective, everything into account, because you need to look at tree species. Is it an appropriate species for a fine turf area? Is it appropriate for in-play areas? Is it appropriate in terms of pest control? My motto is sort of, if you have to spray a tree, you usually don't want it on your property, or at least not very many of them. So you're looking at using indigenous trees for the most part, and ones that don't have undesirable features like softwood, rapid growth, invasive
surface rooting.
Yeah, surface rooting.
That's a risk breaker right there.
Well, yeah, look at what happened to Tiger in the Masters. It's going to happen. I mean, you know, tree roots, even non-surface rooted species will throw up a surface root sometimes. But certain species are just really bad choices in that regard.
You know, this has got to be a tough conversation, David. I mean, you know, you're walking around. Let's just imagine you're out there doing it. I'm sure something like this has come up, and you get to a putting surface or even a tee, you know, a teeing area, and you look, and it's, you know, it probably was a good idea in the 1940s to put that oak there, but now that oak is, you know, now it's only a few inches from the tee area, and, you know, you're out there on the visit with the guy whose idea it was to put that tree there. So where do you begin to, you know, you obviously have to appreciate the sensitivities, right? As you said, all of us like trees, all of us plant people like trees. It's just that choices have to be made. So how do you begin to deal with the sort of soft side of this, you know, the side of it that's not sort of the game related or grown grass related, but is also the attachment people have with these things?
Well, you have to take emotion out of it, and that's not possible for some people. My dad was one. He played golf all his life. He loved trees. He was absolutely fine. If greens died, he wouldn't have wanted you to cut down a tree. And there's no answer for someone like that. And there are people like that, and it's just their perspective. It's not right. It's wrong. Or wrong. It's their perspective. But most people, when you educate them and teach them what constitutes a good tree and what are bad trees, it's an easier sell. And that's why I think you have to get the emotion out of it and get education into it. You also have to think about the architecture of the course, what it was intended to be, what it was originally. Not to say that it may not have been improved or the changes may not have been better, but you need to know what you have to start with. Oakmont wasn't intended to have trees, so, you know, that was a pretty big mistake to have planted it up as it was. But that same thing has happened to hundreds of other courses. But I find that when we evaluate trees, the vast majority of the removals are because the trees are in very poor condition, they have structural issues, or they're competing with one another. So honestly, Frank, I think probably 60% of the removals are to improve tree health to remove competition for the remaining trees, because you said something that was really important. You know, we water, we fertilize, so the growth rate of trees on a golf course is at least double what it is in the wild. And very few people, even experts, can plant trees with their eventual size in mind. And 30 years down the road, when they start growing into one another, you can have two deformed trees or one really good one. And I think that's just all a decision-making process. And if you walk people through the process, get them out there when you're evaluating the trees, they change their mind really quickly when they're met with hard facts and, you know, real good examples of good and bad trees.
Huh. Well, David, as we approach, you wouldn't believe 45 minutes have almost gone by in our conversation. So as we try to bring this full circle, I'm going to ask you a question about both of these issues that we've talked about today. One is winter damage and the other is tree management. And you said something earlier that's really becoming part of our sort of lexicon now, and that's this afternoon shade issue. I think years ago we sort of thought about morning shade, persistent leaf wetness, air movement, prevailing wind, things like that. But I think the intense winter damage we've had in the last several years has brought the afternoon shade or the March-September shade, right, David? The spring and fall shade issues are now emerging. How are you having those conversations in just a couple of minutes, if you could? How are you having those conversations now about afternoon shade? Or maybe I'm just yakking because it's easy because the turf is dead now. How are you handling these afternoon shade issues?
Well, pictures taken in the last month or so are really valuable, because when we do our consultation visits in July and August, the afternoon shade from the tree that caused winter injury or increased the potential for winter injury are not evident because the sun angles change so much. So I find one of my most important tools on consultation visits is my compass. And you need to figure out what trees are blocking light at what time of year. And if you're having a significant amount of winter injury, then you know, you have to get people thinking about winter shade. And that's not intuitive. You know, why do people care about shade when the turf isn't growing? Well, it stays frozen longer, and you have more freeze-thaw cycles. So that's certainly an important one. another important issue is superintendents need to disassociate if they haven't pulled plugs out of the greens during the winter, not necessarily associate what they did this spring in terms of removing the ice layers or snow or leaving them with the result they ended up with. In some cases, removing snow and ice can prevent damage. In some cases, it can cause damage. But unless you know what the turf is, health is, before you take action, you really don't know when the turf died. It might have died in January, and your action in March or February or April may have had no impact on it.
And there, of course, you also see year to year that sometimes your weakest POA or your weakest plants are also in those areas where it's shaded. They're not getting the sun they need to maybe produce the carbohydrates towards the latter part of the season when the days are still long, temperatures are still good, but the light, you know, even into November, Dave, in the Northeast, we'll have leaves on the trees. And as that sun angle gets sharp, those plants, you know, you could argue maybe aren't as hardened off either.
Absolutely. This year was a little disappointing because the turf went in to the winter so well hardened off. I thought that, you know, I thought our chances were pretty good coming out. But there was a winter, I think it may have been 2002, where the turf was not hardened off and it went into the winter and snow cover actually in December, as I recall. And that's a winter that we had damage, and I expected it because it wasn't hardened off. But, yeah, even you need that afternoon or morning and afternoon light, all day light in the fall to get it hardened off. But even then, you can still have problems. So I guess there's no way to eliminate all of our potential for winter injury, but we can certainly improve our chances by taking care of the growing environment, both during the growing season and during the winter.
And I think that, Dave, as I thank you for taking the time out of, I know at this time of year is a ridiculously busy schedule, to sit here and yak with me about this, because I do think that, you know, the thing that I'm really so pleased is that, you know, I remember when you were talking about tree management stuff and you know, it's just everybody roll their eyes and, oh, here he goes again. And, you know, I think, you know, your advocacy for that good growing environment, right, and strategic management of the resources is really, I think, what's made you such an important part of this industry that now sometimes people don't always see the benefits of things we say when we say them. And sometimes it takes, you know, the industry's got to sort of catch up a little bit about the variety of topics. So I wish you safe travels along the road, David. Thanks for taking the time out. And I just want to thank you one more time for taking the time to do this, and I wish you safe travels.
Thanks, Frank. Same to you, and look forward to sitting down with you and having a cold beverage one of these days.
I'd really like that. And everybody, Dave Otis from the United States Golf Association, the director of the Northeast region in the green section for the last 25 years, going into his 28th year with the USGA, and it's been a pleasure chatting with him today. And my name is Frank Rossi. I'm the professor of turfgrass science at Cornell University and Frankly Speaking host here on TurfNet Radio and the TurfNet.com Entertainment Network. Thanks for joining us. We'll look forward to having you back on a future episode.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.